Of course, we have our small business feature, and as usual, we have Pablo Fatidis joining us in studio, founder of Auric Business Accelerator. Pablo, good evening to you. Thank you so much for joining us as usual.
And it's my pleasure as usual.
All right. So this evening, you want to talk about the pricing game and why it's so emotional. And I suppose it's also in response to a tweet then as well from one of our listeners, Sibusiso Mkhatshwa. Sbuda Waruna on Twitter, he put out a tweet saying that the pricing game is emotional. Suppliers raise prices and force you to decide to do one of two things. One, do you segment and risk alienating the very people you want to be serving? Or two, run at a loss until economies of scale kick in, and then you can negotiate a better bulk cost price. Help! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. What is he actually asking for here, Pablo?
Well, look, pricing is very, very emotional. But here's the thing with pricing in business. The economy is an incredibly intricate, deeply connected, interwoven web of one system. Mm. So if the economy is under pressure, everything is under pressure. Yeah. There's no such thing as saying my sector isn't, that sector is. Everything is under pressure because you saw the job numbers. If one sector is performing badly, people lose work. When people lose work, it creates pressure on the available free cash that other people have, because suddenly the community you need to support gets bigger and bigger and bigger with your paycheck.
Yeah.
People have less to spend, and that whole pressure comes down on everything. And very often, when you're building your business, especially in the early stages of your business, and you feel that you're doing everything possible, you're bending over backwards to serve your clients and customers, and then they want to negotiate price with you, it gets very, very emotional. It feels very personal, but it really is not. When people negotiate with you, understand this. They're doing it because they're there. They've got reasons for it, but they like you. The fact that they didn't look at what you're offering and turn around and walk off is already a big advantage. The fact that they're in front of you means you've got some control over the situation. So know that you've got a good product, or you're well-liked, or the service you're offering is a good service, but you need to understand the reasons why they negotiate.
And now it's about keeping them there, right? Keeping them not just having just an interest, but now turning that interest into actual, whether sale or service or whatever the case is.
Well, that's going to depend on the reason why they're negotiating with you.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of things. For some people, it's just in their nature. You know, there's certain communities right around the world, communities that are well represented over here, that are entrepreneurial in the fiber of every bone in their body. They typically are people who've started businesses. Most people who started businesses in this country, in fact, most people who started businesses globally, started with very little capital, if any at all. So this notion that when you see someone who has a business started it because they had money behind them. No, it mostly people start with very, very little, if anything at all. And when you start with very little capital, you develop very particular habits. Everything becomes negotiable. Price, affordability, everything becomes a big feature. And that then builds the DNA of who you are. And there's some people who can transcend that because there's a right time to move beyond that. And there's some people who don't know anything different. So they will negotiate with anything and everything. And in many cases, it's also part of just doing business, creating meaning. It's part of the social fabric of creating relationships in business. Those people are tough to contend with, but play along. Enjoy the game. Negotiate smartly. Let them beat you sometimes. Win other times.
You can't win all the time.
No, you can't win all the time. Not with those individuals. But then there are other reasons. And one of the other reasons is value. If someone is negotiating because they're arguing that there's a difference in value, value is very hard to get right. Because value can be deeply, deeply personal.
Yeah.
In other words, if I say, hey, what's valuable to you? I bet you I've got a different answer to you. So there's no common thread around what defines value. But in business, there's a big opportunity to understand what value means in the case of the product or service you're supplying and to who. And we'll talk about how you actually calculate that. If it's a value issue, then it can be fixed. If it's a competition issue, it can also be fixed. And competition's interesting because So if I have a pen and I'm selling you the pen and you look at the pen and you're negotiating with me, I need to understand what my competitors are offering. In other words, is it the color of the pen? Is it the texture of the pen? Is it the feature on the pen? Mm. Or how do I rate against my competitors? And is my pricing fair given what they've got and given what I've got? And then the third thing that people might be negotiating, and it's happening extensively at the moment, and it'll, in effect, it's going to happen at an even higher rate, is when people turn around and say, but, you know, I've got other options. And that's called a substitute. So, for example, the biggest challenge that Henry Ford had in 1893 when he started his business, he was competing against a substitute form of transport called a horse.
Mm.
And horses were cheaper than cars at that stage.
100%.
So people looked at it and said, well, it's well and good. Your car will get me from A to B, but so will my horse. The two are very, very different product sets from each other. I'll go with the substitute. I get better value. I have some companionship. It talks to me and I've got control over it, whatever the case might be. So he had to contend with that.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of substitutes coming into the market simply because people are looking for cheaper, better alternatives. One of the most recent that we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years in South Africa really has been the rise of Uber. And Uber's now becoming a substitute form of transport to you buying a car and me using Uber. Two different forms, two different products, different categories altogether, but both achieve more or less the same thing. So you need to understand where people are coming from when they negotiate with you. And if you understand that, it helps get rid of the emotion. Because when you take it personally, you're going to behave and respond badly. And the moment you do that, the control you had over you and I negotiating, forcing you to turn around and walk off, means now I've lost you forever.
Yeah. So it doesn't mean necessarily that you have to let go of the emotion. It's just how you deal with the emotion.
Yeah, channel it.
Yeah, finding the right way to sort of filter it through the process and the progress.
You know, I'll tell you something very interesting. About 3.5 months ago, I was away for a week. And I went down to the north coast of KZN.
Yeah.
And there's a very, very thin road. Then you've got the kind of sea and the beach. And right behind that road is a very high, it's all mountains. So everything gets built up on the mountains over there. And I found this road, and the road was about 400 meters long. And honestly, Arabile, it went up, it was like a 40 degree slant. Sure. It was made of concrete. Steep. You know, they couldn't lay proper bitumen on it.
Yeah.
And it was really, really steep. And every morning for the 5 days that I was there, I would run to the road, and then I would run up the road, walk down it 7 times.
Once is enough for me, thank you very much.
No, but it was a very, very, there was a good reason for this.
Mm.
And on about the third day, this guy walks out his house and he says, I've been watching you do this for 2 days now. Is there something wrong with your head? Or why are you doing this? And I said to him, you know, we're going to be doing something really interesting this year in business, and it's going to be tough, and it's going to be full of challenges. And there's going to be a huge amount of resistance behind it and towards it. And I'm doing this so that with every step I take that burns my lungs and burns my body, I say at the same time, it's not personal. It's not personal.
Mm.
It's not personal. And in a tough economy, it's not personal. It feels personal most of the time. It really is not personal. If you allow that emotion to crowd your thinking and you don't contain it in the right place, you will miss out on how to use the levers of pricing in order to get ahead of the market and win that deal with your customer.
Mm. Finding those substitutes then are the ones that have certainly hurt, as you mentioned here as well. Then it's the substitutes that have sort of got you thinking to yourself, how do I make my product better? How do I ensure then that I give and I give the best, as we mentioned, quality, value, etc. But are those substitutes ones you should be worried about?
Yeah. No, you have to worry about anything that competes with your product or service.
Yeah.
But there's only value in worrying about it if you understand how to actually get your pricing done. So pricing technically has got two levers to it. There are technical levers and there are artistic levers. And the technical levers are made up of three components. The first is that when you produce a product or a service, you've got costs.
Yeah.
So if you're making something, if you're producing something, if you're manufacturing something, you've got raw material costs, you've got input costs, and input costs are really hard to calculate. For example, electricity or water or whatever the case might be. You've got labor, you've got packaging, you've got the whole process of getting the raw materials in, you've got the whole process of getting the finished product completed, and then you've got the process of getting the product to customer. All of those elements, some of them you can see, some of them you have to just understand and interpret, form the cost structure of the product itself.
Yeah.
You need to understand those costs. You've got the cost of the product, and you've got the cost of delivering the product. So once you've got those costs understood, and you realize that to make your particular product and for me to sell it to you is going to come in at $100, whatever the case might be, I need to sell it for more than 100 rand. 100 rand is my base price.
Yeah.
Anything less than that, I'm in very, very serious trouble. The next thing you've got to figure out is, well, what is your competition doing? What are the substitutes doing? If someone is offering a very similar product or a very similar service to yours to a very similar kind of customer for 90 rand and the market going price is around 92, 93 rand and 100 rand, I'm not saying you won't sell it, but just realize there is a limit to the price point that you can put on there. And it's going to be defined firstly by your costs and secondly then by your competition. Then the third piece, and this is the hardest piece to calculate, is the value that your product offers that customer. And this is where it gets tricky. And this is where Sibusiso's biggest opportunity and any business owner's biggest opportunity lies. Because there's a formula for value, and the formula for value goes like this. Without your product, without your service, I have a problem. And the cost of my problem is going to be 50 rand. If your product is coming into me as a solution to my problem at 100 rand, is there value? No, you're burning me by 50 rand.
Yeah.
But if the cost of my problem is 1,000 rand and your product can solve that problem for me at 100 rand, the value of the service you've offered me is 900 rand. And when you start to look at value like that and start to learn to calculate value in monetary terms, then all of a sudden, your underlying cost, which you know is your base price, your competitors' prices out there, largely become irrelevant because you're selling on a completely different proposition. You're selling on a value-based proposition.
Mm.
And here's the reality of where we are today. And it hasn't been different for many, many years, even in the good years when the economy was actually growing.
Yeah, and doing really well.
People only ever buy things that solve a problem for them.
Mm.
And if you can't see how your product or service solves a problem, then my argument to you is you don't really understand the business you're in because you don't really understand your customer. And if you can't quantify the problem that you're solving for that customer, then you don't really get how to compete in the market that we live in today. You will never step ahead. You will always be pushed back on price. And that's a terrible place to be.
Mm. So, in this pricing game, trying to, one, take out some of that emotion, as we mentioned, the technical issues to this is, you mentioned value, mm-hmm. but cost. How do you make sure you have the right costing for whatever it is, your service, whether your product, whatever the case might be?
Well, I mean, look at how, let's call it a solution. Look at how the solution you're offering gets delivered. And it might well just be a physical product. But for a physical product, here's a good example. A physical product could be a car. Let's say you are in the market looking for a 1.8 liter sedan.
Yeah.
Now there are, how many are there? There must be a choice of at least 50, I'm guessing, against different brands and different styles.
Mm.
And each of them will put themselves forward as having a point of difference.
Yes.
And one might have more technology than the other. One might have a bigger brand than the other. And what's the value of that brand, actually? You need to think about that very carefully because a brand suggests value. And then as a buyer, you're going to look at this and say, well, what actually is the value? And the value is going to come by way of motor plans. It's going to come by way of better insurance rates. It's going to come by way of that particular car having more readily available parts or lower costs of servicing.
Yeah.
When you become skilled at understanding how to sell value, you need to do that calculation on the cost of the entire package that you're offering the customer and communicate that as the value they get over and above a sedan that might look 10,000 or 15 or 20,000 rand cheaper, but it doesn't have the full bouquet of services that create the value experience for you.
Mm.
And that's crucial. That cannot be done properly without good costing strategy, because if part availability is going to be better than the next brand, that means in my organization with my brand, I need to be sure that I carry parts.
Yep.
I can't order the parts from overseas. The parts need to be locally made, because availability of parts is one of the promises I've made to you. There's a cost that comes into that. So the costing process goes well beyond the vehicle. It goes around all the packages that you offer to improve the value and the experience you hope that the customer will have that will sway them to buy your car as opposed to somebody else's car.
Mm. Which makes you better than the competition, which is another technical facet then of this pricing
game. No, it doesn't make you better. It makes you different to the competition.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. You can't be all things to all people. There will be people out there who will say, you know what? I'm prepared to save 50 grand on a car and wait 3 extra weeks or an extra month, because I'll use Uber in between until the parts arrive.
Mm.
But saving that 50 grand up front is a big deal for me. The other people who will say, no, I need the car. Uber doesn't work for me. I need the car. I need the car available all the time. It's a priority for me. Those are two different kinds of customers.
Yeah.
And that's why I say you cannot be all things to all people, because customers have got different problems based on who they are, where they come from, and their situation. And if you don't understand who the customer is, by definition, you can't understand the problem. By definition, you can't ever have a value sell. You're constantly going to be put into a position where you're selling on price.
Mm. Another one of the artistic, as you put it forward then.
So the artistic lever, what does it look like?
Yeah.
Now, this is something you'd be good at.
Okay.
Yeah, you would be. And the main reason is that, you know, once you've developed a product and or a service, and you understand the technical features, you understand the commercial features, you understand the problems that you solve and for who, you need to be able to communicate that.
Mm.
And communication means a couple of things. Number one, you need to be able to turn it into words that will resonate with your customers emotionally first. So you can't sit there and talk about product features. You've got to go straight to the heart of the problem they experience that you believe your solution can solve for them. And your ability to narrate that and to articulate that.
Yes.
And your ability to build campaigns to generate interest in what you're offering is in part science, but in part it really is artistic. You can call it the wrapping of the product. If the wrapping resonates with me, if the wrapping is nice and shiny and glistens and it looks like it's holding real magic behind it, that's what marketing is. It needs words. It needs a great website. It needs a great brochure, if that's how you're marketing. It needs very clever campaigns. It needs thoughtful communication. Mm-hmm. That takes time to develop. And I can tell you this much. So we've been running Auric now for 14, 15 years.
Sure.
And still, every year, we reshape the communications. And the reason for it is this. When time goes by, the problem statement that people experience change. It changes because of age. It changes because of economy. It changes because of your access to power or depletion of power, whatever the case might be. Because your life changes, your problem statement changes. And if you don't communicate in the right way, I might miss you. Even though I've got the perfect solution for you, you will not see nor hear anything I've said, because my messaging behind what I have to offer isn't properly constructed and wrapped.
Sure. All right. So selling it correctly certainly becomes a huge facet then to get things right. Pablo, in this last part, we then talk about what happens if you still don't get it right. What happens
if you've done this and it still hasn't worked?
Everything. I've listened to Pablo Fatidis on the Money Show this evening on Thursday and said on the 1st of August that this is the way I'm going to go. I go about this. it doesn't work for me, what then?
It means one of, look, there are many things, but let's talk about the two big things.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the two opportunities. It's a wonderful opportunity to suddenly realize that you're throwing good money after bad. There are certain cases where the business you're in, however you got there, for whatever reason you might be there, is the wrong kind of business given your set of circumstances.
Yeah.
If it's a commodity or a generic product, for example, baked beans, you're never going to compete with ShopRite or Pick and Pay or Woolworths or whoever it is, because baked beans is a commodity product. It's bought and sold on price. Differentiating one can of baked beans to the next can of baked beans is really hard. And those generic products really are the domain of big buying power.
Yes.
And that's the domain of big business. Mm. So if you are in that space, stop and find something that's going to give you a point of difference. If you're not, and you're still not getting it right, then change the rules of the game around how people buy that solution.
Mm, innovate.
Yes, and I'll go back to it. And it's a well-worn example, and I use it because everyone now is familiar with it. Uber could never have bought taxis and opened up a taxi rank. If they did, what they came into the market was they found people who were well-established.
Yeah.
You've got these things called medallions that cost a fortune of money in New York, for example. If you wanted to compete with New York cabs or the London cab or whatever the case might be, there were no opportunities to get in.
Mm.
So what did they do? They changed the rules of the game. And in that, they took the cost of doing business out of the model. And through that, they competed and, in fact, outcompeted the formative established players.
Yeah.
And about 3 weeks ago, we did a show on this, exactly that. So if you're listening and you want to get access to it, go into the podcast, get that show, let me know. I will send it to you.
Yeah.
But innovation is a science too, and it's absolutely possible to anyone out there listening.
Pavlo Fatidis, thank you so much for your time this evening. Founder of Auric Business Accelerator, then joining us for our small business feed.